welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFURL's weekly podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Alyssa DeCarbonell, Deputy Program Director for Europe and Central Asia at the International Crisis Group, and a former colleague of mine. We worked together at Reuters in Moscow about a decade ago as the initial Russian aggression against Ukraine was beginning to unfold, 2013, 2014. A lot has happened since then. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining me, Alyssa.
Thanks, Steve. You know, when I left Moscow after spending my last year basically in Crimea and Donbass to cover the start of the war, one of our former Reuters bosses told me, "You can't leave now. Russia's finally becoming a big story." So I had felt like the 7 years before that of reporting had been pretty busy, but that does seem like another era now.
Yes, absolutely. I arrived in Moscow with the AP before working for Reuters 2002. Things seemed quiet for about 1 year, and then a lot of news started happening. But not a lot, I guess, compared to what started in 2014. So you're certainly right. It's great to have you on the show. Great to talk to you again. And I'd like to focus mainly on what's known in shorthand as the grain deal. The UN-brokered and Turkish-brokered corridor agreement that allowed for the safe shipment of Ukrainian grain across the Black Sea to the Bosphorus and then to destinations around the world. Allowed, past tense, because Russia quit the deal, and it expired a week ago as a result of Russia's withdrawal. Alyssa, following the Kremlin's announcement, you wrote on this website that Russia's move was, quote, a depressing signal of its fanatic adherence to waging war in Ukraine in spite of the costs to its economy and image, unquote. Certainly in terms of image, it seems like a strange move because the deal was helping to alleviate a global food crisis and essentially had no opponents, unless I'm mistaken. Turkey helped broker the agreement. China was in favor of it. And its existence essentially enabled Russia to argue that despite its war on Ukraine, it was helping feed the world. So, Alyssa, you also wrote in the same thread that Russia, quote, sees for now that it gets more from hurting Ukraine than staying in, meaning staying in the grain deal. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on why Russia would pull out of the grain deal, given the risks for its economy and its image. And the second part of this question is whether this withdrawal, whether this seems permanent. Is the grain deal dead, or is there a chance it could be revived in the near future? One thing Russia tends to do under Putin is create problems with other countries and the world in order to then be seen or try to be seen as resolving them. So could the deal be revived, maybe in connection with the Russia-Africa summit, as it's being called, later this week, or Putin's possible visit to Turkey in August?
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, it seems like I couldn't refrain from some strong wording in reaction to the latest escalation. So I think there are two parts to answering your question. There's Russia's current calculation that it gets more from quitting the grain deal itself, for now at least. And then there's the wider lens of what we might glean from that decision, among others, about the course of the war. So on the grain deal, the Kremlin is accomplishing a couple of things by blocking Ukrainian exports right now. First, of course, it's hurting Ukraine's economy. The deal had provided a lifeline for the economy that's been, you know, destroyed by the war. From the get-go, Russia's military strategy had included attacks on the agricultural sector, on infrastructure, ports, farms, which is now nowhere near pre-war levels of production. In the winter, we also saw Russia strike energy infrastructure. All of this is with the goal of squeezing Ukraine's economy, potentially destroying its viability as a state, as Russia would have it. In a way, we could look at the grain deal itself, which was dubbed this beacon of hope by the UN Secretary General, as an exception rather than the norm in this conflict, as we are seeing it in year two of the conflict. Second, Russia also sees and understands very well that in dropping the deal, it can add to some recent friction between Ukraine and its eastern neighbors, Poland and four other EU countries that lie along alternative routes for grain exports from Ukraine, albeit at much, much lower volumes than through the Black Sea, have asked the EU for restrictions on these. They say that it's creating a glut and depressing domestic prices in their own markets, so difficult for farmers there. And third, really, Russia might even reap some economic benefits. It's one of the largest exporters of grain, and it's due for a bumper crop this year season. So it may be looking to grab some market share from Ukraine. And doing so would also allow it to strengthen its trade relationships with other countries, because, you know, grain and food exports are a very important component of trade relationships between countries. Although this is going to, I guess it's going to, it should be said, this is going to be hard to track because Russia stopped publishing data on its exports and its agricultural trade is now mostly conducted by sort of shady middlemen. But in any case, Russia had been complaining and in fact obstructing the implementation of this deal for quite some time. And in pulling out now amid the harvest, it may just double the hurt. We've seen for years that Putin is quite aware of using energy and other exports as a tool and as leverage in relationships with other countries. So it's fully aware of what it's doing and adept at manipulating the market dynamics. And finally, Russia is again pushing its own demands. So that's on facilitating its own agricultural exports. As you mentioned, these demands it has framed as removing Western obstacles to improving food security for the global South. And that's a narrative that has rallied some sympathy in some quarters. So for the Kremlin right now, the main downside is to manage the blow to Russia's image. So as you pointed out, even allies, China and Turkey, who have been key beneficiaries of this deal, have urged for its resumption. But the Kremlin may believe its propaganda is working. Putin has said the deal is not benefiting the most food insecure countries. I mean, that's not true. That's not the case. The deal was never intended to ship wheat directly, but allow more volumes on global markets, so lowering prices overall. And incidentally, the UN World Food Program bought 80% of its grain last year from Ukraine. Putin has even said that Russia was ready to replace Ukrainian grain on the world market, including free of charge, as it is expecting a record harvest this year. The FT had a report saying Russia will push this proposal at the summit that you mentioned this week with other African leaders. So either it thinks it can manage this narrative, or the other, you know, way of looking at it is it simply doesn't care about this particular downside right now. That's where we get to the bigger picture on the Kremlin's war plans and to your question, you know, of is this a negotiating strategy? If so, Russia is taking quite a maximalist stance with the attacks on Odessa and infrastructure since. I think it's a pretty strong sign that it's not looking to rejoin the grain deal anytime soon, at least not without real wins on its supposed demands. We can talk about what those are. I mean, briefly, it was to reconnect the SWIFT, its agricultural bank, to the SWIFT financial system. And it was expecting ammonia exports to flow through a pipeline that is reportedly damaged now through to the Black Sea through Odessa. But I'm not quite sure that its actions since quitting the deal is going to put counterparties in a conciliatory or negotiating mood to achieve those demands. But there's also a second audience for all of that. And that's the domestic audience in Russia. In the wake of the turmoil in Russia with the Wagner mutiny, blocking Ukraine's grains exports and attacking its export infrastructure, as I said in my thread, is signaling its determination to keep fighting and to keep fighting dirty.
Thanks very much, Alyssa. I learned a lot in that from your comments. Interesting about the UN World Food Program and the way the grain is bought. It's a great point that the demand, or maybe so-called demands, we've seen in the past in this war and before it, before the full-scale invasion in February 2022, Russia using demands that were either, really they could not have expected to have been fulfilled. I'm talking about Russia's demands of the United States and NATO in the months ahead of the invasion, essentially kind of revising the results of the Soviet collapse and mm-hmm. the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. These demands were presumably issued kind of as pretexts, among other things. So, I think it's hard to look at the demands as kind of straightforward. I'd like to now get into what's been happening since Russia withdrew from the grain deal. And we touched on this a bit, Russian forces have been attacking the Black Sea port city of Odessa relentlessly. And this is a city that, in the past has been, it's a mostly Russian-speaking city, or was. It's where there have been in the past sympathies toward Russia. I think those are pretty much gone now. Russia's been attacking Odessa relentlessly, attacking grain and port facilities, but also other targets. Strikes early on Sunday severely damaged the city's main cathedral and other cultural sites in the center of the city. That cathedral was affiliated with what, at least before the invasion, was the Moscow-backed or Moscow-controlled branch of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Russian strikes have also hit sites in the center of the city, other sites in the center of the city, lots of cultural sites. The historic center of Odessa is a UNESCO World Heritage property, and the UN Cultural Organization said, I think as early as Friday, that several museums within that protected property have been damaged by Russian strikes. And of course, as in Russia's attacks across Ukraine, people are being killed and maimed and their homes destroyed. The attacks on Odessa have attracted a lot of attention and have added to anger at Russia over the unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. And now, in the past couple of days, there have been attacks now on grain facilities in Ukraine on the Danube, including in a town that is across the Danube from Romania, a NATO member, about 200 meters away. So there's been a focus on that. Russia is attacking that alternative route, the Danube, as an alternative route to the Black Sea and the Bosporus. Alyssa, this may not be a fair question, because Putin and Russia have shown time and again that they seem to have no qualms about killing civilians and destroying cities and towns, including their cultural treasures. But I'm wondering what you think about the attacks on Odessa and now on the Danube ports. Is it really all related to the grain deal? And what if anything, did these attacks say about where the war might be headed? You wrote that the war is increasingly becoming the raison d'etre of Putin's rule. Is this part of that, or is it all about the grain deal?
Yeah, great question, Steve. So I don't think it's all about the Green Deal. Obviously, the Green Deal itself can tell us something about where the Kremlin is going with the conflict to a certain extent, because it's a key decision maker, and the attacks, of course, are a shift in strategy since the last year, where Russia was more or less adhering to this to this deal. Among Russia watchers, there are those who look more or less intensely at Russian domestic drivers for foreign policy decisions. There are also those who claim more or less to know Putin's mind. I tend to be in the camp looking more at how domestic developments may be shaping the Kremlin's strategy, though, to be honest, I'm a little fuzzier on reading Putin's mind. So what I was talking about in my Twitter thread and what you're alluding to is, I mean, I think we can see that the war is becoming increasingly existential for Putin. He had to shift his aims, as we saw with the announcement of the annexation of territories in East Ukraine that Russia doesn't fully control. But defeat or any end of the fighting that would be perceived as a defeat isn't really an option for him. So the narrative that the Kremlin is locked into of a geopolitical or even a cultural clash with the West, and its disinformation and its narratives about the Ukrainian state and its leaders, is so core to Putin's rule now that I think it's unlikely to change. Now, in the wake of the Wagner mutiny, Putin is consolidating his grip on power even further. He's cracking down, including on nationalists who are pro-war, but had criticized the way it was waged. He's using the war to shift the power balance in the economy, to reorient Russia's trade relationships, but also at home, you know, he's nationalizing some Western assets we've seen in recent days. He's privatizing others, all of this to suit political patronage needs. So I think, you know, the timing of this move and the attacks that have followed the decision to withdraw from the Green Deal sends a message at home about his commitment to the war and how to wage it.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. You know, focusing especially on the domestic message of that, I guess he's killing several birds with one stone, so to speak, you know, sending messages to the world as well. You mentioned Putin's attempt to crack down on nationalists, on the pro-war, the camp or the people who are in favor of the war, but feel that he has not been fighting it correctly and not aggressively enough. Imagine that. Alexei Navalny had an interesting comment about Igor Girkin, you know, who was arrested, who had a big part in the start of the war in the Donbass in 2014, and who was arrested last week. Navalny said that Girkin was cursing the cannibals for their lack of appetite, which I thought was a good description of this group, but that he is essentially a political prisoner because he's because he was arrested and he's presumably charged not with something like war crimes or his involvement in shooting down the Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, but instead for criticizing Putin. I think you brought a lot of things together with talking about the some of the domestic motivations, I guess, of this of what Putin and Russia are doing in the wake of and pulling out of this grain deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Navalny's comments are interesting, also because generally speaking, the way the opposition has reacted to Prigozhin challenge to Putin and the developments is quite interesting and kind of dual. It's in many ways very strange, but certainly Gherkin. I mean, it is something to see this man who was instrumental to the start of the conflict. You know, and we were talking about, you know, I was in Slovyansk for a bit when he was sort of ruling there a decade ago, not quite a decade ago, but and now he's been jailed, while Prigozhin hasn't, incidentally. So that's another interesting dynamic. But you know, these people had been important, I think, to Putin because they had been voices that were in favor of the war, and that was something he needed until this point in time when he's starting to see the danger of those, and it's more about keeping his hold on power at home.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you mentioned Prigozhin, that the mutiny apparently, you know, having been responsible for killing 13 Russian pilots, you know, and Prigozhin is now presumably headed in Belarus. And that looks like part of Russia's or Putin's attempt to kind of increase control over Belarus. But we can get into that another time. I would like to take a few questions if there are any. Mention some of the ways to ask. So let's just give it a minute. Okay, I'm not seeing any for now.
I mean, I see a comment from somebody about we didn't mention the Ukrainian attack on the Kerch Bridge, which might be interesting to draw into the conversation. Obviously, a lot of people thought the timing of Russia pulling out of the Great Deal was maybe linked to that. And obviously, Russia said its attacks on Odessa were in retaliation. You were talking about how to parse the fact that Russia is kind of indiscriminately attacking and bombing Ukrainian cities. You know, the fact that the war has come closer to home with the drone strikes, with incursions over the border, with this attack on the Kerch Bridge that actually affected people who were on vacation in Crimea, it's making it more, and obviously the Wagner Mutiny, which opened this other front at home, you know, where the facts of how the war was being waged and the sort of very raw, rude, full of swear words, descriptions of what was happening on the front line from Prigozhin, you know, brought a lot of that back to Russians. So, you know, Putin's also having to deal with that now, the kind of these cracks in the official narrative about the special operation in Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the Wagner Mutiny, you know, whatever, however short-lived and, you know, whatever questions there might be about it, you know, it's almost fading into the past, but, you know, the takes, you know, this was widely seen as sort of the beginning of the end for Putin, or, I mean, I have problems with that particular formulation, but, you know, a huge challenge. You know, he's obviously dealing with, and as you mentioned, you know, dealing with problems that were problems in his from his position that were unexpected. You know, you mentioned kind of the biggest one, I guess, which is that he's had to adjust the goals, you know, of the war after the initial failure and what everybody believes was his expectation, Putin's expectation that Ukraine would be subjugated within days or maybe a couple weeks. You know, it's interesting. It's important to kind of see this as You know, and I think you're kind of also mentioned Putin doesn't have much recourse, you know, any kind of outcome with an end to the fighting could be seen, you know, as a loss, as a defeat for him. And I think mm-hmm. there are two sides to that coin, because some people say, well, Putin could easily or fairly easily explain away or describe any kind of outcome or you know, as a victory. Mm-hmm. Even some say if Russia had to withdraw its troops, but you know, I think so. But I think it's certainly dealing with things that he did not expect. Okay, yeah. I'll see if there are any other questions.
I mean, I think the thing, just to comment on that, is that, you know, Russian disinformation only goes so far, and the war is useful to Putin at home, at least at the moment. In a way, you can talk about, you know, what kind of face-saving, you know, way out for Russia. But there's two problems to that. One is, you know, how does the West and Ukraine ensure that there won't be a return? And if you're looking at, you know, to fighting or how can you guarantee any kind of end to this conflict, but also for Putin at home, since that's what we're discussing, what replaces it? I mean, what was so shocking about the Wagner mutiny, I agree with you, I think, you know, some of the reactions were a little overblown, but it did, for the first time, kind of focus minds in Moscow on what comes next after Putin. Is there an after Putin?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned the war being his, more and more being his raison d'etre, you know, and so it's over. You know, why is he needed, I guess, is a question. So I'm not seeing any more questions. I'd like to, I have one just about this Russia-Africa summit. I believe it's Thursday and Friday. Mm-hmm. From what you said, you know, about the chances of a return to the deal, it doesn't sound like you think that's what's, you know, going to happen at this meeting. It may be more of a kind of Russia pushing the narrative of, you know, we're the ones helping the global South, I guess, and we can take care of it, and also, I guess, pushing its demands and trying to portray itself as being on the sort of the right side of this somehow. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what we're going to see. It's definitely going to work on its narrative. I mean, you know, the exit from the Black Sea Agreement did anger some governments in Africa. I mean, I don't, you know, and also I think, you know, some Western countries will definitely use this in their attempts to get other countries to be more united behind Ukraine rather than trading and continuing diplomatic relations with Russia, such as going to the summit in St. Petersburg. You know, I think it's really interesting. This FT article I thought was really interesting about a, you know, a very specific agreement that Moscow was trying to push to kind of send grain for free with the help of Qatar and Turkey to African states who might need it. There's certainly going to be an attempt to say the grain deal wasn't doing what it was meant to do, which is not true. And we can step in instead. And if that doesn't go forward or nobody takes Russia up on that, then it's able, you know, Putin will be able to say, oh, well, look, you know, the West is obstructing, or people are obstructing, are not taking us up on our offer to, you know, send free grain or to put more grain on the market. So, I mean, I think that will be part of it. And you also mentioned there's this, you know, potential trip to Turkey. But, you know, it's complicated timing, I guess, there's no bones about it, right? It's complicated timing for Russia to have pulled out of this deal right before this summit. So I think there will be some difficult conversations. Obviously, there will also be questions about Wagner's role in Africa and what happens there by some African leaders, I expect. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, that's a great point about Wagner's role in Africa and how that may be something that the visitors will want to talk about. People will be watching that closely. All right. Well, thanks very much, Alyssa. Really great insights, I think, on these issues, a pretty broad range. But I will wrap it up here. Alyssa, great to talk to you. And thanks very much for your analysis.
Thanks, Steve. It was great to speak to you.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Alyssa de Carbonell, Deputy Program Director for Europe and Central Asia at the International Crisis Group. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, and other podcast platforms. I'll be back next week for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, and please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on Friday. Thanks for listening.